Thank you very much. I'm going to speak fairly slowly and as clearly as I can, but if at any time you don't understand or I'm speaking too quickly or too softly, please do say. I'm a bit jet-lagged, so if I suddenly start snoring, you know it's caught up with me. It's not Jane Austen, it's just the flight. So I'm going to talk today about why we still read Jane Austen, why, after 200 years since her death, her novels still appear on every poll. She's still voted for among the best novels ever. But why? So first of all, why? And this is not the reason. I am devastated to tell you there is no wet shirt scene in Jane Austen. And it's always a giveaway if a student writes about that scene where Mr. Darcy jumps in the lake. And you know they have seen the movie, but they haven't read the book. But not everybody loved Jane Austen. Some people strangely hate her. Mark Twain said, every time I read Pride and Prejudice, I want to dig her up and hit her over the skull with her own shin bone. It's incomprehensible. I think he was jealous. So what did she write? 6 major novels: Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, Mansfield Park, Emma, Persuasion, and Northanger Abbey. And then the unfinished, abandoned The Watsons and Sanditon. The epistolary novel, the novel in letters, Lady Susan, which wasn't published in her lifetime. And some fragments, some teenage writing. So if you've read the 6 major novels and are devastated because there's no more, there is a little more. Your Austen is not quite finished. And what does she write about? It is not chick lit. I cannot emphasize this too much. She does write about love and romance, but she is not sentimental. Unlike the adaptations, the denouement, the most important part of the novel, is not the big kiss or the proposal or the wedding. Jane Austen's novels often go beyond the wedding, or they stop short, or they move sideways. She was an unsentimental person. I don't know if any of you have compared in the various novels the declaration scenes, the scene where the man says, I love you, will you marry me? But they're not big. They're not like in the movies when the music rises and you get the close-up. They're not like that at all. Often, very little is said. It has to be admitted that the heroes are Englishmen, so they probably wouldn't say much. Englishmen are not the most articulate and certainly not the most demonstrative of lovers. So in that way, she is accurate. But I think she had a great horror of the sentimental and the soppy, the big mmm. It's not for her. And she was practical and pragmatic. Yes, the novels are about love, but they're not all about love. If we say that there is a morality in Austen's novels, it might be, yes, it's wrong to marry for money, but it's stupid to marry without it. Yes, it's good to marry for love, but it's not enough. They are about property and security. They're also about seeming and being. The great crime in Jane Austen is hypocrisy, trying to seem something you are not. And I'm going to talk more about that later. And there are no zombies. I don't know how many of you have read or seen the film of Pride and Prejudice and zombies, but I'm afraid no zombies in the real Jane Austen. Although I'm sure that this and the film gave Jane Austen a whole new slew of fans, a whole new group of people who read her work but were probably very sad that there were no flesh eaters in it, unless you count Mrs. Elton. There have been a number of different attempts to make Austen relevant or popular to the young. I'm not sure they've all been in her best interest. This, for example, I'm not sure if you can see it, is the way in which Pride and Prejudice was marketed to teenagers. It's like a teenage magazine. We have How to Cure Your Boy Crazy Sisters, Lizzie on Love, Loss and Living, Bingley's Bring Bling to Britain, Who is Mr. Darcy? I'm not sure this gives the right impression about Jane Austen, and I haven't used this edition in my classes. So I said it's about property. It's about the estate. It's about the house. It's about having a roof over your head and not being on the streets. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a young man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. However little known the feelings or views of such a man may be on his first entering a neighbourhood, this truth is so well fixed in the minds of the surrounding families that he is considered the rightful property of some one or other of their daughters. What a fantastic beginning. It's a brilliant beginning for a number of reasons. This beautiful, symmetrical sentence could have come from Samuel Johnson. It could have come from one of the great Augustan stylists of Jane Austen's youth. It sounds so reasonable, so logical. If this, then that. But it completely inverts the conventions of the day. The Petrarchan convention that the woman is the prey and the man is the predator. Not here. It also completely inverts the economy of the day. Married women owned nothing. This takes place decades and decades before the British Married Women's Property Acts. The minute you marry, everything you own belongs to your husband. Anything you earn during the marriage belongs to your husband. You leave money in your will to a friend. He can cancel it. Women very rarely have bank accounts. They very rarely enter business. They very rarely invest. So this idea of possessions, of money, of fortune, of ownership, is very important. And the idea that the young man can belong to the woman, and that the man is the prey, and the older ladies of Meryton are the predators, is both comic but also serious. And Austen is very good at this. It's comic, but it's serious. It makes you laugh, but it might also be very worrying. So she's inverting this idea of property, and she's in one way laughing at Mrs. Bennet and her cronies, but on the other hand, she is also pointing out something very important. When we read Mrs. Bennet, we laugh at her. She's a gold digger. She's a matchmaking mama. She's ridiculous. She's nervous. But at the end of the novel, four wealthy young men have come into her circle, and four young men have gone away with wives. And as she says to her daughters, when you have five daughters, tell me what you will be thinking of. Because Mr. Bennet has not saved money for them. They are not wealthy in their own right and cannot be. They are not educated enough to be governesses. What will become of them if they don't marry? The likelihood is they will become poor relations of someone else, which is a fairly bad fate in those days, as we can tell from letters and journals, or they become some man's mistress, and then they're passed on, and they're passed on. They end up on the streets. A man, they will be lucky if they live 2 years. So it's suddenly not so funny. It's suddenly quite serious. But is Jane Austen arguing that you should only marry for property, for security? Those of you who have read Pride and Prejudice will remember Miss Lucas. Charlotte Lucas is pragmatic. She marries the odious Mr. Collins to get away from her family because they treat her very badly. She is a superfluous woman. She's that awful thing, the unmarried old maid. She doesn't love Mr. Collins. No, nobody could. But she marries him anyway. But is she condemned? Not by the narrative voice. And is Elizabeth gold digging when she says this? Her sister, Jane, says, "My dearest sister, now be serious. I want to talk very seriously. Let me know everything that I am to know without delay. Will you tell me how long you have loved him? It has been coming on so gradually that I hardly know when it began, but I believe I must date it from my first seeing his beautiful grounds at Pemberley." Now again, this is half serious, half joking. When Elizabeth goes to Pemberley, she's very impressed. It's a beautiful big house with beautiful grounds. And she sees an Elizabeth-shaped hole there and thinks, "I belong there. This is for me." But also, it is a well-kept estate. It is a well-run estate. The servants respect the master. He is a good husbander of land, and therefore he is good husband material. So it's not just the wealth. It's not just the status. And Elizabeth is a sensible woman. She might have made a bit of a mistake at first. She chose to like the wrong man, but now she's making a good decision. Those of you who have read Mansfield Park will perhaps remember how it begins. And it begins with what I call marriage mathematics. Okay, we are told that Miss Maria Ward of Huntingdon, with only £7,000, that's her dowry, £7,000, had the good luck to captivate Sir Thomas Bertram of Mansfield Park. And he is a baronet with a good house and a good income. And even her uncle agrees that she is at least £3,000 short of any equitable claim. So this is a formula. It's very clear. Pretty girl plus £7,000 equals less than baronet plus good estate plus good income. Therefore, pretty girl plus £10,000 equals a baronet with a nice house, a good estate, and a good income. And everyone knew how much everyone was worth. At this time, you could roughly work out income from the kind of land people owned, but also the income from investments in the funds was stable. It was 4.5% to 5%. So if you knew how much capital someone had, you knew how much income they had. And as we see, when Mr. Darcy enters the ballroom, everybody knows he's got £10,000 a year. So he's a millionaire, in other words. And this is just the sort of thing people would have said. You walk in, they've summed you up. They know what you're worth. They know how much your petticoat cost, practically. I mentioned the importance of the theme of seeming and being. And this, I think, gives a good illustration of Jane Austen's language. She makes language work very hard. Her lexis is always important, the word choices. So when we first open Emma, the novel Emma, and we learn about Emma Woodhouse, we may not immediately notice it, but all the information we are given is qualified in some way. This, but this. This, but maybe this. This, but not quite this. And after a while, we realise that this spoilt little princess on a pedestal is actually to be pitied. It's not so clear that she is just handsome, clever, and rich. She's lonely, and she's intellectually frustrated. Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, and rich, with a comfortable home and happy disposition, seemed to unite some of the best blessings of existence and had lived nearly 21 years in the world with very little to distress or vex her. And it goes on like this. She didn't have much to vex her, but there was this. The evils of her situation were this, but she didn't know them yet. She lost her mother very early, which is sad, but so early she doesn't really remember. She has Miss Taylor instead of a mother, but she's not quite a mother. They get on very well together, but Emma ignores her and does what she wants to do anyway. And all the way through, it seems this, but it is this. It is qualified. And very soon we realise that Emma is suffering under delusions, that Emma thinks that she is the seer, the know-all of the novel, but that she is not. She's often wrong. She is absolutely full of illusions. And that the person in the novel who is the clear seer is Mr. Knightley. And, of course, he's going to put her right. But what do we read Jane Austen for, really? It's not the plots. If we read Jane Austen for the plot, we wouldn't read her again, would we? We know what happens. So why do we read her again and again? Why is it that when I've nothing else to read, I start Jane Austen again and I read each of the novels at least once a year? It's the style, isn't it? It's the narrative voice, the voice that tells us the story. We've seen it being mock formal, this kind of mock heroic Augustan opening to Pride and Prejudice. It also uses irony and humour, some quite broad comedy. And Jane Austen is an innovator of characterising vocabulary, of making the dialogue of her characters idiosyncratic, so that each character speaks in a different way. And this is quite new. Most of the people who wrote novels before Jane Austen tend to make all their characters speak in the same way, with some exceptions. So, for example, in Fanny Burney, we have a mock French accent because everybody knows that the English, who are all monoglots, think anybody who doesn't speak English is very funny. Sorry about that. But Austen tries to give different characters different length of sentences, different extent of punctuation, different word choices, and that's quite new. She also uses free and direct discourse. This is something we associate with modernism, but Austen did it first. Free and direct discourse is where a narrative voice is telling us the story, so it's using the third person pronouns, he, she, but it takes on the style of the character. So it takes we readers close to Emma or Elizabeth or Anne or Catherine. It's a very useful technique if you are creative writers, to keep a distance from your characters so you can be ironic about them, but sometimes to take your reader into their minds. And she uses metatextuality. That is, sometimes she steps out of the fictional frame and has a little chat with us. She admits it's a book. And she uses I. And the author appears before us. So this narrative voice, it's omniscient. It can see everything, which is very useful. It can tell us what this person is thinking and that person is thinking. but it often uses a limited perspective. That is, it takes the heroine as the focaliser, the person through whose eyes we see. And that's very useful in a novel such as Emma, which is in part a detective story, because Emma must not know what's really going on. And if we see things through Emma's eyes, we don't know what's going on either. We might guess, we might think, Jane Fairfax, she's feeling guilty, what has she done? But we don't know. So it's the most flexible way of writing, which is very useful. But the narrative voice is not neutral. Although the narrative voice is what we call extra diegetic, it's a character who is not in the story, it is opinionated. It tells us what to think about people. It tells us this is a bad person, this is a good person. It's judgmental. If you read, if you read Victorian accounts of Jane Austen, you would think she was a sweet, gentle, lovely woman. She never has a bad word to say about anybody. She loves children and sweet little kittens. No. Jane Austen was judgmental. She was the sort of person who would sit quietly at a dinner party but would be thinking evil thoughts about you. And she didn't like children much. She didn't like small, fluffy animals that much. She was too intelligent to be sweet, charming Aunt Jane. She was perceptive. She was sharp. She could be acerbic. She could say some fairly terrible things. Put your hand up, please, if you've read her letters. Okay, if you have read the letters, you know she's not always sweet, gentle Auntie Jane. And the novels are judgmental too. That's what I like best about her. She can be horrible. And I think women are judgmental. We do watch, and we might not say something, but we're always judging. Sometimes the narrative voice is parodic. Those of you who have read Northanger Abbey will know that it parodies and pastiches the Gothic novel and the novel of sentiment that was so popular during Jane Austen's youth. They were going out of fashion by the time this was published. So, for example, in the novel of sentiment, the heroine is always perfect. She makes you sick. She's good, she's virtuous, she's talented. You know, she's born speaking French, Italian, German, and Latin, and able to play the piano and the harp. And always she must be an orphan so that the evil, wicked count can abduct her. So Jane Austen thinks this is ridiculous. So we have, her mother was a woman of youthful plain sense, with a good temper, and what is more remarkable, with a good constitution. She had three sons before Catherine was born, and instead of dying in bringing the latter into the world, as anybody might expect, she still lived on, lived to have six children more, to see them growing up around her, and to enjoy excellent health herself. So obviously she's not a heroine of a sentimental novel. What is she thinking? Sometimes the novel is satirical. When we open Persuasion, we are very surprised that it takes a long time for the heroine to arrive. The novel is very carefully structured so that Anne Elliot, who is disregarded, who is nothing, who is only Anne, even arrives late. And the opening is dedicated to her father, who is an appalling man. He considered the blessing of beauty as inferior only to the blessing of a baronetcy, and the Sir Walter Elliot, who united these gifts, was the constant object of his warmest respect and devotion. I mentioned this mock formality, and quite often some of the wicked things she's saying are disguised in the most formal of language. I've given you a definition of irony here, because students often say to me, what's the difference between sarcasm and irony? And why is Jane Austen's writing so famous for its irony? I think that the reason she can be so ironic is because, as I said, she combines this third person narrative voice, the storyteller who is not in the story, with sometimes taking us into the minds of the character. Emma is in some ways the first truly modern novel. And that's because it's a novel of motivation, a psychological novel. It's not all singing, all dancing, or car chases, or murders. On the surface, nothing much happens. But we learn about Emma from the inside. We learn about her desires and her motivations. It's a character-driven plot, whereas many of the novels before were plot-driven characters, characters who were two-dimensional and thin, and they are there to move the plot along. But in Emma, things happen because of personalities, and that's very important. And because of this dual nature of the novels, the distance perspective and the close perspective, irony can happen. Happy for all her maternal feelings was the day on which Mrs. Bennet got rid of her two most deserving daughters. That's a typical judgmental statement made by the narrative voice. And you will remember that in Persuasion, Sir Walter Elliot is a bad father, a bad landlord, a bad estate owner, and he has to leave the estate because of his debts. His tenants will be very glad to see him go, but he is so completely blinkered he has no idea of this. So we have Sir Walter prepared with condescending bows for all the afflicted tenantry and cottagers who might have a hint to show themselves. And that so beautifully encapsulates Sir Walter Elliot's personality. He is so arrogant and vain that he believes that everyone will be weeping, saying the master is going, when they're saying, yay, maybe we'll get a good landlord now. But not only the narrative voice uses irony, but some of the characters as well. We have irony in dialogue. So, for example, from the witty Mr. Bennet, here he's talking about the odious man who has run away with one of his daughters and yet has the face, as we say in England, the sheer gall to come and show himself and expect congratulation. "He is as fine a fellow," said Mr. Bennet as soon as they were out of the house, "as ever I saw. He simpers and smirks and makes love to us all. I am prodigiously proud of him. I defy even Sir William Lucas himself to produce a more valuable son-in-law." So I mentioned that in dialogue, Austen makes much more effort than her predecessors to give characters idiosyncratic ways of speaking. Different lengths of sentences, different forms of syntax. Some people use slang, some people use more formal English. So, Mr. Bennet is always very sardonic. "You mistake me, my dear. I have a high respect for your nerves. They are all my old friends. I have heard you mention them with consideration these 20 years at least." His daughter Lydia talks like someone from the 18th century stage. There's a famous play with a character called Lydia Languish, who's rather like Lydia, and she uses expressions that no one else in the novel does. La! And she interrupts herself, she goes off in different directions, and she freely confesses she doesn't listen to other people. "La, you are so strange. But I must tell you how it went off. And there was my aunt all the time I was dressing, preaching and talking away, just as if she was reading a sermon. However, I did not hear above one word in 10, for I was thinking, you may suppose, of my dear Wickham." Very typical of her. Then we have Mr. Collins, pompous Mr. Collins, who speaks in long sentences and he uses long words where he can. And he often uses words such as condescend and humble. He's not humble at all, of course, except to his social superiors. She is unfortunately of a sickly constitution, which has prevented her from making that progress in many accomplishments which she could not otherwise have failed of, as I am informed by the lady who superintended her education and who still resides with them. But she is perfectly amiable and often condescends to drive by my humble abode in her little phaeton and ponies. Now, Sir Thomas Bertram in Mansfield Park is beautifully caught. He never uses the kind of exclamations that Mrs. Norris uses. You know, the tags that you get after speech, like she said, he said. With Mrs. Norris, it's often she exclaimed, she cried. Never with Sir Thomas Bertram. And he doesn't use short sentences. One of his sentences is 98 words long. And he's very thoughtful. He doesn't say anything quickly. There is a great deal of truth in what you say, replied Sir Thomas, and far be it from me to throw any fanciful impediment in the way of a plan which would be so consistent with the relative situations of each. I only meant to observe that it ought not to be lightly engaged in, and that to make it really serviceable to Mrs. Price and creditable to ourselves, we must secure to the child, or consider ourselves engaged to secure to her hereafter, as circumstances may arise, the provision of a gentlewoman, if no such establishment should offer, as you are so sanguine in expecting. So notice he uses double negatives, he uses embedded clauses, he uses words such as sanguine, he uses circumlocutions. It's very much the stately Tory landowner speaking here. His son, young Tom, is quite different. He represents the young Regency, so he uses slang. He speaks in shorter sentences. It's quite different. I see what you are at. You are quizzing me and Miss Anderson. I sat there an hour one morning waiting for Anderson, with only her and a little girl or two in the room, the governess being sick or run away, and the mother in and out every moment with letters of business. And I could hardly get a word or a look from the young lady. Nothing like a civil answer. She screwed up her mouth and turned from me with such an air. Now that's very, very different. We have a scene in which Sir Thomas accuses young Tom of having robbed his brother for 10, 20, 30 years, perhaps life, of the income that should be his. And Jane Austen shows Tom's thoughts on the subject, very quickly moving away from any idea of guilt, any idea of responsibility. And the way she does it beautifully characterizes him. And then we have John Thorpe, the horrible John Thorpe in Northanger Abbey. He's the sort of man who, if we went out with him today, would tell us all about his car. You know, it's got leather seats and it's got chrome bits on the side, it's got spoilers and go faster stripes, and he'd tell us all about the tyres and the engine until we were bored silly. John commits two crimes in the novel. He talks about money, which is vulgar, and he talks about reading when he hasn't read the books. He also recommends to Catherine a very unsuitable book. He recommends The Monk. Those of you who've read that gothic novel, The Monk, will know it's about incest, rape, murder, demonology. Oh, you imagine it, it's in it. And it would be very wrong to recommend it to a young woman. But here he's talking about his curricle, his gig, his small carriage. Curricle hung, you see, seat, trunk, sword case, splashing board, lamps, silver moulding, all you see complete, the ironwork as good as new or better. He asked 50 guineas. I closed with him directly, threw down the money, and their carriage was mine. So he's boring, he's vain, he boasts, and he exaggerates all terrible crimes in Jane Austen. He has sort of written on him bad man from the beginning. And here, I think you must like Udolpho if you were to read it. It is so very interesting.
Not I, faith. No, if I read any, it shall be Mrs. Radcliffe's. Her novels are amusing enough. They are worth reading, some fun and nature in them.
Udolpho was written by Mrs. Radcliffe, said Catherine, with some hesitation for the fear of mortifying him. So that's a terrible crime. He says he's never going to read that. He's going to read this. Well, that is this, so that's very bad. Those of you who've read Northanger Abbey will remember that it contains the famous defence of the novel, where Jane Austen really steps forward. One of the characters says, of course, you don't read novels. Gentlemen read much better things. And then we get this wonderful defence of the novel in which Austen says, only a novel, only a novel. All human life is there. How can you not value the novel more than the kind of cut-and-paste anthology that was popular at the time? And you can hear the voice of the angry novelist in every word of that famous defence. So free and direct discourse. It seems as though the narrative voice steps back a little bit. It's still there. We know the narrative voice is still there. It's not stream of consciousness like in, say, James Joyce's or Virginia Woolf's writing, because the pronouns are the third person. But the storyteller is not very obvious. We feel close to the character. So here, Elizabeth is thinking. Her astonishment as she reflected on what had passed was increased by every review of it. That she should receive an offer of marriage from Mr. Darcy, that he should have been in love with her for so many months, so much in love as to wish to marry her, in spite of all the objections which had made him prevent his friends marrying his sister, and which must appear at least with equal force in his own case, was almost incredible. Now, we know that's Elizabeth's thoughts, even though the pronoun is she. It's not the narrative voice telling us. The narrative voice knows it's not incredible. But to Elizabeth, it feels this. And the exclamation marks are because to Elizabeth, it's a shock. Oh, my goodness, he's proposed. So we feel very close to Elizabeth's mind there. And the technique is used also to comic effect. Those of you who have read Emma will remember the strawberry picking party at Donwell Abbey. And the great talker, Mrs. Elton. Here, free and direct discourse is used to give a very good impression of what it's like on a hot summer's day. You've all been picking and eating strawberries, and this woman is rabbiting on. She's talking, talking, talking. You're not really listening. Bits of it float past your head and come into your ears, whether you like it or not, however much you try to block her out. And we get a wonderful sense of the movement of her long monologue. The way in which she always says the first thing that comes into her head, and the way in which she contradicts herself. So, I'll try to be Mrs. Elton. Mrs. Elton, in all her apparatus of happiness, her large bonnet and her basket, was very ready to lead the way in gathering, accepting, or talking. Strawberries, and only strawberries, could now be thought or spoken of. The best fruit in England, everybody's favourite, always wholesome. These the finest beds and finest sorts, delightful to gather for oneself. The only way of really enjoying them, morning decidedly the best time, never tired. All every sort good. Hautboy infinitely superior, no comparison. The others hardly eatable. Hautboy's very scarce, chilli preferred. Whitewood, finest flavour of all. Price of strawberries in London, abundance about Bristol, Maytal Grove, cultivation, beds when to be renewed, Gardeners thinking exactly different, no general rule. Gardeners never to be put out of their way. Delicious fruit, only too rich to be eaten much of, inferior to cherries. Currants more refreshing. Only objection to gathering strawberries, the stooping. Glaring sun, tired to death, could bear it no longer, must go and sit in the shade. And now you've moved from the most wonderful fruit in the world to, well, no, and I'm tired. And from, I'm never tired, I could do this all day long too, I'm going to stop now. And I think it gives a brilliant tour de force of this characterization. One of the objections that some critics have made of to Austen's work is that she represents a woman's world, a domestic, very closed, narrow setting. Partly that's true. There are female central protagonists, and if there is a female focaliser at the time, their life is likely to be quite narrow. Fair enough. But it's sometimes said that there are no scenes in Jane Austen where a woman is not present. That's wrong. There is one. There is a scene in Mansfield Park, which people always forget, in which Sir Thomas and young Tom are talking. We also do occasionally get into the mind or personality or feelings of male characters. So, for example, in Emma, Mr. Knightley's emotions are revealed through involuntary body language. He's tired, he's lacking energy when he thinks that Frank Churchill and Emma are in love. And his language even changes. So we do, to an extent, get a view of men. Tony Tanner famously wrote, "During a decade in which Napoleon was effectively engaging, if not transforming, Europe, Jane Austen composed a novel in which the most important events are the fact that a young man changes his manners and a young lady changes her mind." Well, yes and no. We do not go to war because Elizabeth doesn't go to war, but we do see the effects of war. In Pride and Prejudice, the militia is moving south. They're going to Brighton. The militia is like the Home Guard, and they're going to Brighton because it's on the coast and there are fears of invasion, very genuine fears of invasion. We also learn about the Navy in Mansfield Park and Persuasion. Jane Austen, of course, had two brothers who were sailors. And perhaps more importantly, we see the effects of the wars. The wars have decimated the population of suitable young men. It's the beginning of what was called the superfluous woman syndrome. There were more marriageable women than there were eligible young men. So women are in competition for the remaining young men. And you see that, I think, all the way through Austen's work. So although, yeah, we don't face the cannons, we don't go to the peninsula, we don't sail with Captain Wentworth, nonetheless, the war is present in the novels. It's just off stage. This is the ending of Persuasion, and it's in its way quite radical. Talking first of all about Mrs. Smith, the great friend of Anne Elliot's, who has been ill, and then we're told that Anne's spring of felicity is the warmth of her heart. Anne was tenderness itself, and she had the full worth of it in Captain Wentworth's affection. His profession was all that could ever make her friends wish that tenderness less. The dread of a future war, all that could dim her sunshine. She gloried in being a sailor's wife, but she must pay the tax of quick alarm for belonging to that profession, which is, if possible, more distinguished in its domestic virtues than in its national importance. So first of all, this may seem an odd ending for a love story. I mentioned that we don't get the wedding. We don't get the big, soppy, sloppy scene. We've gone beyond it here. Remember, Austen is writing with hindsight. The novel is set during the Hundred Days' Peace. But Austen knows that the peace will be broken, Napoleon will escape, a war will start again. Secondly, look at some of these words. Yes, she's a sailor's wife, but more importantly, the argument is that Anne belongs to this profession. She belongs to the Navy. At this time, men are paying a new tax, a tax that's going to become an income tax. It's to raise money for the war. And they are paying in coin. The argument here is that women also pay tax. The tax of anxiety and fear for their husbands, their fathers, their brothers. And that Anne, too, is in a way a sailor. And that's a very bold statement, a very radical statement to make for a woman at this time, and a very unusual way to bring to end what might otherwise be seen as just a romance. I mentioned metafictionality. At the end of Northanger Abbey, Austen reminds us that we're reading a book. We're told that we're all hastening together towards perfect felicity. Oops, sorry. Of course, if you're reading on a Kindle or you're reading on a computer, it's very different. But for Austen, the anxiety which in this state of their attachment must be the portion of Henry and Catherine and of all who loved either as to its final event can hardly extend, I fear, to the bosom of my readers, who will see in the telltale compression of the pages before them that we are all hastening together to perfect felicity. It's as if Austen says, ha-ha, I caught you. You were empathising. You were living vicariously through these characters. You were getting a bit romantic. Well, I'm not having that. I'm going to pull you out and remind you this is a book. This is a story. To begin perfect happiness at the respective ages of 26 and 18 is to do pretty well. And professing myself, moreover, convinced that the general's unjust interference, so far from being really injurious to their felicity, was perhaps rather conducive to it by improving their knowledge of each other and adding strength to their attachment, I leave it to be settled by whomsoever it may concern whether the tendency of this work be altogether to recommend parental tyranny or reward filial disobedience. Now, this is Austen being very cheeky. At this time, the novel was quite low down in status. It was considered rather as we might consider video games. It's bubblegum for the mind. And often, novelists, to give some respectability, to gain some status for their work, will say, oh, no, my novel's not like that. It has a strong moral. It's morally educative. It's uplifting. Austen laughs at this and says, not me, no. My tendency may be to reward parental tyranny or reward filial disobedience. Even in Mansfield Park, she steps forward as if to say, I'm not giving you the big romantic ending, forget it. Let other pens dwell on guilt and misery. I quit such odious subjects as soon as I can, impatient to restore everybody, not greatly in fault themselves, to tolerable comfort, and to have done with all the rest. I've had enough. No more. Austen lived in the Regency period. She's a Georgian. It's living in this Hanoverian dynasty that took over Britain at the time when the real inheritors of the crown were Catholic and therefore debarred. And she cordially detested the Prince Regent. Initially, when he was a young man, he was very popular. He was considered the handsomest man in Europe. They called him Prince Florizel. And initially, it was a great honour to meet him. I am full of joy, she wrote to her sister, at much of your information that you should have been to a ball and have danced at it and supped with the prince. And this is him in the 1790s. It's not my idea of handsome, but hey. But opinion deteriorates. Later on, she writes, I suppose all the world is sitting in judgment upon the Princess of Wales's letter. That's his wife, whom he divorced. Poor woman, I shall support her as long as I can, because she is a woman, and because I hate her husband. I mean, that's a very radical thing to say in a letter. You could be put in prison for that. But can hardly forgive her for calling herself attached and affectionate to a man whom she must detest. I do not know what to do about it, but if I must give up the princess, I am resolved at least always to think that she would have been respectable if the prince had behaved only tolerably by her at first. So she detests him, but unfortunately, he's a fan. She learns that the prince keeps a set of her works in every one of his houses. This is a famous cartoon of the prince. Here he is a gentleman. Here he is no gent. He's sitting on the lap of his mistress. He's carousing. And here he's the regent. He's a fat, rather disgusting old roué. So she receives an invitation to go to his London house, Carlton House, and his librarian shows her around. He says, the Prince Regent has kindly, generously, nobly given you permission to dedicate your next novel to him. Aren't you thrilled? And she thinks, oh my God. And she writes, among the many flattering attentions which I received from you at Carlton House on Monday last was the information of my being at liberty to dedicate my future work to His Royal Highness the Prince Regent without the necessity of any solicitation on my part. I entreat you to have the goodness to inform me of how such a permission is to be understood and whether it is incumbent on me to show my sense of the honour by inscribing the work now in the press to His Royal Highness. In other words, do I have to? And James Stanier, the librarian, writes back and says, yes, you do have to. So, Jane Austen, always ready to turn a problem into an advantage, writes to her publisher and says, well, the printers are taking a very long time. If we tell them the Prince Regent is going to have a dedication, will they hurry up? And she also writes to her publisher saying, what is the minimum I can say in this dedication? Can I just say, Emma dedicated by permission? And he writes back saying, no, you cannot say just that. This is the minimum that you have to do. Very different, very grovelling, very humble. And you can imagine Austen gnashing her teeth and pulling out her hair, but it had to be. So Emma was dedicated to His Royal Highness, the Prince Regent. This work is by His Royal Highness's permission, most respectfully dedicated by His Royal Highness's dutiful and obedient humble servant, the author. James Stanier Clark started to write to Austen saying, I've got this great idea for a novel. You could write about a clergyman who's a bit like me, actually, and I'll just tell you about myself. And Austen writes back saying, very, very diplomatically, oh, no, I'm just a woman. I'm not educated now. I'm not clever enough. I couldn't possibly. So he says, well, why don't you write a historical novel about the House of Coburg? And she writes back saying, oh, no, only a scholar could do that. Poor woman. She must have, once the secret of her authorship was out, she must have had all these suggestions. Oh, you could write my story, Miss Austen. But she was very good and very polite about saying no. I'm delighted to say that Jane Austen is going to, in a way, meet the current Queen because she's going to be on the £10 note. So finally, after only 200 years, she's getting some, at least, of the recognition that she deserves. I'm slightly horrified to say that many people complained about this and that the woman who suggested it even got death threats. But I think Austen would be very amused if she knew about it. Thank you very much.
Hello. Can you hear? Thank you very much, Sandy. This was wonderful. And I had some questions myself, but I already received several questions from the audience. So I'm just going to go ahead and ask them, translate them, so that you can relate to those questions. So we have one question from Gloria Figueroa. She is asking, considering Jane Austen's epoch and the fact that she was a woman, where did she get her inspiration to create such diverse characters, situations, and different narrative styles? And is it possible to call her a genius, or is she a product of a person that just emerged through her own effort?
Interesting question. Inspiration is always difficult to measure. When I teach the Brontes, people say to me, they lived in a parsonage, in a tiny village, miles from anywhere. How did they invent these characters? And I say, well, they had an imagination. And that is true also of Austen, but also, of course, she read widely. Her father allowed her to read his books. We know that she read in a careful and critical way. She learned from other writers, but from a very young age, certainly from the age of 13, she thought she could do better. And she learned that great trick, which is first to imitate and then do something different. Take techniques, but not ideas. And as for the question of genius, I suppose it depends what you mean by genius. We think of Albert Einstein as a great genius, and yes, he's born with a fantastic brain, but he also works at it. And I would say that the same is true of Austen. She had gifts, she was born with great gifts, but she also worked hard. Her brothers, when they wrote about her, and her nephew, tried to say that she was an amateur. They said that she didn't write for money, she didn't write for fame, and when you saw her write, it was like drawing. Just straight, spontaneous, she didn't go back, she didn't think about her audience. Rubbish, rubbish, and rubbish. We have some of her manuscripts, we can see the alterations, the crossings out, the changes of mind. She was a professional. We have her letters. She says, I have earned £120, which only makes me wish for more. And she writes when she's a child about how she wants to be famous. So, yes, she's born with certain gifts. She was very clearly articulate, very clearly perceptive, but she also worked hard. So, genius, yes, but hard worker as well.
Thank you. That was Gloria asking that. So the next two questions I'm going to amalgamate because they're very similar between them. First of all, Jose, and the other one is an anonymous question. Jose Valdez, thanks for your conference, and he would like to ask if currently there is any author whose books are similar to Jane Austen's books, and also what writers marked Jane in her literary style.
Jane Austen was influenced by Richardson, by Burney, and by others of her predecessors and contemporaries, although I think she bettered them. So writers such as Susan Ferrier were writing on similar subjects, on similar themes, but they lacked her sharpness, I think, and they lacked the light touch of irony. And a number of authors I think we would not have now if we hadn't had Jane Austen. So, for example, in the 1840s and 50s, the Victorian period, we have social problem novels, which Jane Austen isn't writing, but we also have novels such as Elizabeth Gaskell's Wives and Daughters, which is similar to Austen in some ways, and which I think couldn't have happened without Jane Austen. Even some of Dickens, his irony, his characterising vocabulary, I think he's learned from Jane Austen. So certainly Elizabeth Gaskell, Margaret Oliphant, people who are writing in the generation following her, but also 20th century writers. So for example, E.M. Forster in some ways has learned a lot from Austin. And even now, I think Austin is, or reading Austin is a very good apprenticeship for becoming an author. And not everybody, as I said, liked Austin. So, for example, Charlotte Bronte despised her work. She felt it lacked passion. She felt it was like a beautifully drawn miniature, but it was just too much like real, ordinary life. It wasn't exciting enough. And yet, I do feel that Charlotte Bronte learned from Jane Austen, that novels such as Shirley owe a lot to Austen. So I think her influence continues today. Some of the best-selling contemporary writers, such as Margaret Atwood or Ian McEwan, have learned a lot from Jane Austen, I think.
Even writers such as Samuel Beckett, right?
Yeah.
And I was thinking of Anita Bruckner also.
Yes, Anita Bruckner is often said to be a low-key, well-observed miniature, just like life version of Austen, yeah.
So we have time for a couple of more questions. One question that is interesting because it might be controversial has to do with women. So this is Soledad asking about the fluidity of the narrator in Jane Austen. And would that be because she is a woman and we think in that way with more ease or in a more natural way? This is what she's asking.
Well, I wouldn't like to be sexist to say that women have a better way of thinking or writing than men. Perhaps the person who asked the question could say a bit more about what they mean. Can't hear. Never mind. I think that Austin might say the answer to the question is yes. We can't say Austin was a feminist. That would be anachronistic. And she never says, oh, a woman should be a soldier or a lawyer or a priest. But she never says women are inferior to men either. She may believe in the separate spheres of activity, but not that women were inferior. And she might well think that a woman's life, the way a woman has to live life and the things that she is denied, the activities that she is denied, will make her more introverted, more alive to nuance, to subtlety, perhaps more of a keen observer and responder to people than men were at the time. So she might agree with you.
Thank you. This is another Soledad, and she's asking, care to comment on irritating Fanny Price, judgmental and self-righteous?
She is. Yes, Fanny Price uses the word judge, judging, judgment, and judges more than in any other of the novels I know, because I've counted them. She is passive. She can't do very much. She can't be very active and autonomous. So what does she do? She sits and watches and judges. And she is quite self-righteous. She's quite cold. The only people she really likes and is, not judgmental of are William and Edmund. She is the one person in Austen's novels who uses the word slattern, which means a slut. And she uses it of her own mother. But of course, she only thinks it. And perhaps it's not surprising, since she's always sitting in the corner watching life and, you know, is picked up and put down like a parcel. She doesn't have much autonomy. She's not the agent of her own life. Perhaps it's not surprising that she becomes like that. And she is the moral centre of the novel. She is a mirror of the Tory Augustan values of Sir Thomas Bertram, but she's better at it. He makes big mistakes. And her name is very important. She is judged by her price at first, her monetary value. And it's only later that she is evaluated for her moral worth. Not everybody liked Fanny Price at the time, and not everybody likes her now. She divided opinion. Austen collected some opinions of Mansfield Park and wrote them in her little journal. And some people said, particularly older people, oh, this is the best novel because it's the most moral. It tells us how to behave. And others said, oh, Fanny, boring, boring, we don't like her. And it was a great shock after Pride and Prejudice, after the light and bright and sparkling Pride and Prejudice. Some people did not like Mansfield Park at all, but it does have a lot to recommend it.
So we're going to finish with one more question. This question also deals with women and having a fulfilling life. Why women's happiness must turn to marriage and fortune? Why, if Jane found her time being as independent writer? Yes, that's the question.
Do you mean why did women focus on marriage and,
well,
and make that their goal?
Well, I guess it has a historical context. Mm.
There wasn't much else for them, is the short answer. If you were upper class or middle class, your options were severely limited. You would not receive the education of your brothers. You couldn't do the kind of things that your brothers could do. If you were not married, you were going to be despised and poor. In one of her letters, Austen says, single women have a dreadful propensity for being poor. The lower middle classes and the working class, well, women did work, but they weren't very enviable jobs that they did. They were hard, they were tough lives. If you were a middle class girl or an upper class girl, you were molded for marriage all your life, and if you didn't marry, you were a failure. Among the very few new options was writing. For the first time, starting a century earlier with Aphra Behn, women were earning money by publishing. Before that, it was very difficult to earn money from publishing. There was no copyright laws. Works tended to be pirated. Authors were paid very little. But Alexander Pope had changed that. He had really begun the process of the professional writer, the writer who didn't rely on patronage, but earned money from his royalties, and who demanded that he get those royalties, and who took people to court if they pirated his work or didn't pay him for it. And Austen benefits from this. But of course, she can't publish under her own name because she would lose her reputation. If she seems to be publishing to, as they say, bandy her name about in public, she's not a lady. Also, because of her brothers, to show that you have to work as a woman reflects very badly on the men of the family. It suggests they can't afford to look after the dependent women. So she publishes, first of all, as by a lady, and then by the author of Sense and Sensibility, and so on. Even when she's buried, the brothers do not put on the slab that they put on the north aisle of Winchester Cathedral that she wrote. They say she was virtuous, she was good, she was kind, she was Christian, she was the daughter of da-da-da. They do not mention that she wrote. It's 100 years later that the Jane Austen Society puts another slab on the wall that says, oh, and by the way, she wrote a few things as well. But Austen managed to make some money from writing, not nearly as much as the most popular authors of the day, for example, Sir Walter Scott. It wouldn't have made her rich, but it gave her some independence. After her father died, the pocket money he gave her stopped. The family had very little money. And she would have been destitute, apart from a few gifts of the odd guinea or two at Christmas from a wealthy aunt. But it gave her money, enabled her to receive letters, because at the time you paid when you received them, to buy gifts, even to buy some clothes. And that must have made a great difference to her self-respect. And I'm very glad that she did get it.
Thank you so much. We're running out of time, so we're going to close now. But I would like to thank Professor Sandy Byrne, and really comment that after 200 years, after Jane Austen's death, we're still talking about these issues that seem very relevant and not at all outdated.
Absolutely.
So thank you very much. Please, a big applause for Dr.
Thank you. Thank you, Nicholas.
Thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.